Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It's not an image that inspires great confidence, but sometimes the people running this economy are along for the ride just like the rest of us. The Federal Reserve released the minutes of its latest meeting today. They're not so worried about the housing slump. Consumer spending's humming right along, and corporate profits are quite nice. But inflation is still the monster hiding under the bed. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Society for Human Resource Management, HR, leading people, leading organizations, online at shrm.org. Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices, calvert.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Glad you could be with us today. It's Wednesday, the 21st of February. Check your economic calendars and you'll see today's the day we get one of those A-list indicators. The Consumer Price Index came out this morning, inflation by another name. It's not so bad. The core rate was up 0.3% last month, mostly on a drop in energy prices. But get a load of some of the other details. Airline ticket prices were up. Hotels and rents were up. Tobacco was up. And medical care prices had their biggest jump in more than 15 years. Knowing that, this next number shouldn't come as too much of a shock. A study out today in the journal Health Affairs predicts national health care spending will double in the next 10 years to more than $4 trillion. One out of every $5 we'll spend will be for health care. And Marketplace's Amy Scott reports Uncle Sam will be footing more of that bill.
It's no surprise that healthcare costs are rising, but the Health Affairs report suggests there's another reason Americans are spending more. John Poizal is the study's co-author and a deputy director with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. He says lately people are earning more money.
As incomes increase by 1 percentage point, typically expenditures for healthcare increase by 1.4 percentage points.
By 2016, Poizal says the federal and state governments will cover nearly half of all national medical expenses. That's partly because Medicare began offering a prescription drug benefit last year, so the program's costs have jumped. And the first wave of baby boomers will soon be eligible for Medicare. Paul Ginsberg heads the nonprofit Center for Studying Health System Change.
The government's obligations for health care are growing faster than the revenue base. So ultimately, it's going to mean higher taxes.
As the government covers more of the country's medical bill, the kind of single-payer system some Democrats have been pushing doesn't seem far off. Don McCann with Physicians for a National Health Program says when you include public employee health plans and tax subsidies, the government is already paying 2/3 of the nation's health costs.
And that's about what most nations pay for their government-sponsored health care programs. So we're paying for national health insurance. We're just not receiving it.
If we were, McCann says the government would save on the order of $350 billion a year in administrative costs, and a single payer could use its clout to negotiate lower prices. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Let's say you're an industry with a shady reputation, and let's say you want to keep regulators off your back. What do you do? Well, how about a little self-regulation? The payday lending industry spending $10 million to polish its public image, as Nancy Marshall Genzer reports from Washington.
Critics compare payday lenders to loan sharks who leave consumers swimming in debt. They offer cash advances with triple-digit interest rates. But the Community Financial Services Association of America, a payday lending trade group, says now certain borrowers will have more time to pay up. And association member Mary Jackson says ads for what the group calls frivolous loans will be banned.
When people in the industry say, hey, come get a loan to go gamble or go party on Friday night, that was not a proper call to action for consumers to come in and use our service.
This is the association's new call to action.
We want you always to use payday advances responsibly. Payday advances are never designed to be a long-term financial solution.
But Chris Kukla of the Center for Responsible Lending says the flowery new ad campaign offers no guarantees that irresponsible lenders will be punished.
What enforcement mechanism is there? I mean, they might get in trouble with their association, but there is no real penalty to pay.
Some state legislatures have either banned payday lending or enacted penalties. But University of Florida law professor Christopher Peterson says payday lenders have lobbied hard against more regulation.
They've been winning for the past 15 to 20 years, but legislators are starting to see the consequences of payday lending.
But payday lenders are still raking in about $6 billion a year. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Walmart seems to be bouncing back from its sales slump. The retail giant announced improved fourth-quarter earnings yesterday, and the company's continuing its PR campaign, too. It announced earlier this week it'll be moving into economically depressed areas, trying to improve inner-city life. And today, the Financial Times reports Walmart has approached its major suppliers with yet another initiative. Ashley Milne-Tite has that story.
Walmart says it wants more diversity among suppliers so it can better reflect the makeup of its customers. Charles Fishman of Fast Company magazine has written extensively about Walmart. He says while Walmart critics may carp about opportunism,
here's something they're doing that we think is good. If you want companies to change, you need to be supportive when they do something that you like. And I think this is a really interesting move.
Although he says some suppliers might not welcome the idea of Walmart meddling in their affairs, the move follows a successful push to get law firms that work for Walmart to up the numbers of women and minority lawyers. The retailer's muscle means its latest initiative could have a major effect on diversity at suppliers. Still, Dan Butler of the National Retail Federation says Walmart's not in the vanguard here.
I think that there are many other companies who have reached out to their vendor communities, but I also wouldn't take away from the accomplishment that it is for them to be doing it at this point in time.
Meaning, he says, that the company's internal diversity program is strong enough that the time is right to branch out. Retail analyst Howard Davidowitz confirms Walmart is continuing work it's already begun.
The biggest effort they've made, frankly, is by linking bonuses for its senior managers to making diversity targets. And Walmart did that 2 years ago.
Davidowitz says these moves may well be in response to problems Walmart has been facing, such as accusations of sexual discrimination. Still, whatever the motive, he says, the company's doing the right thing. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Wall Street was of mixed minds about that inflation report we opened with. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Airbus got another kick in the pants today. British Airways announced it's buying 4 new jets from arch rival Boeing with the option to buy 4 more. It's probably small solace, but BA added it was a close decision whether to buy from Airbus or its main competitor. The news comes during a tough week for the European airplane maker. On Monday, Airbus postponed a major reorganization plan it's hoping will cut costs. Costs that are being driven by delays in the A380 Super Jumbo, $6.5 billion in lost earnings so far. But times haven't always been so bleak for Airbus. John Newhouse is the author of a new book about the Boeing-Airbus rivalry. Mr. Newhouse, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
I don't want to put too simple a point on what is an amazingly complex question that we'll get to later, but what the heck happened to competition in the aviation industry?
Well, I think there has been competition all along the line. I think competition dwindled a lot about 25, 30 years ago because Boeing's main competitors, McDonnell Douglas and Lockheed, were exiting from the business, starting with Lockheed. They had made a number of mistakes, and McDonnell Douglas was not only making mistakes, it gradually reached the stage where it couldn't really afford to, because not only was Boeing well ahead of it, but this tiny wannabe from Europe, Airbus, was beginning to eat its lunch.
Where did Airbus come from? Did somebody sitting in France and Germany just get some idea one day that they're going to build an airplane and go from there?
I don't think they decided to build an airplane. I think that the French and the Germans and the British and, to a lesser extent, the Spanish decided to pool their resources because no one of their companies individually was strong enough to compete with the much larger American companies. So they created something called Airbus Industry. For a period of roughly 13 years, starting in 1985, they were brilliantly led by a guy named Jean Pearson, who retired in 1998. So Airbus came roaring ahead. Boeing really never thought that could happen, but it did.
deserved or not?
Deserved, in my opinion. But it's really better to be lucky than smart, because Boeing was able to survive its mistakes and in the end come produce an airplane that's been a runaway bestseller, the 787. It made that decision belatedly and rather reluctantly. And, of course, the decision has been fully vindicated, whereas Airbus's mistakes, few mistakes, have really hurt the company enormously.
What role do airlines have in the success or failure of a major aerospace manufacturer?
Huge. I mean, a single airline or two can make or break an aircraft program, and that has happened. Airbus has gotten into very deep trouble. In 18 months, it slid into much deeper difficulty than Boeing had during its decline, because it had to postpone deliveries of an airplane they wanted, this so-called super jumbo. But those same airlines have responded by ordering more of that airplane, because it is in the larger interest, or maybe the highest interest, of these airlines, the ones that are intelligent and well-led, to keep two suppliers in the game. No airline wants to be at the mercy of a single supplier.
So while it might seem now that we're at a great divide in the aviation industry, with Boeing going with the 787, the Dreamliner, and Airbus going with the huge A380 that has caused it all these problems, you say that in 3 or 4 years you and I could have the same conversation and it would go a different way?
I think so. I mean, Airbus was still making good airplanes, more economically than Boeing. But after Jean Pearson left in 98, he was replaced by a guy named Noël Forjar. And Forjar coasted for a while because he had Pearson's order base. But then he started making decisions on his own, and these decisions have been extremely damaging to Airbus. But they've gotten rid of Pearson, and they've managed to, I think, rationalize to some degree this crazy jerry-built corporate structure they have, a structure in which the French and the Germans have equal voices. So you don't have the sort of unitary leadership that Boeing has. It's a sort of cross-border skirmishing, French-German. So they're beginning to calm that down a bit. It hasn't gone away, but it's less divisive than it was. And I think Airbus is gradually going to get its act together.
John Newhouse's latest book is called Boeing versus Airbus. Mr. Newhouse, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you.
Tuition this year at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology is $33,400. Throw on another $13,000 or so for room, board, and books, and MIT runs about $46,000 for a 9-month school year. For those who'd like something cheaper, MIT has an alternative pricing plan. Everything regular students get except the diploma. Total cost, not much more than an internet connection. Janet Babin has more from the Marketplace Innovations Desk at North Carolina Public Radio.
Maybe where someone got their degree doesn't impress you. But who isn't curious about what makes some colleges so expensive and so competitive? Well, now a few of those elite institutions are pulling back the curtain on the secret formula, making top-notch courses available online for free. MIT was one of the first. MIT lets you peruse its open courseware program, where you can see a class syllabus, review quizzes and answers, and even watch videos of class lectures. A faculty committee created the program several years ago as it worried that the internet might pass MIT by. Online students can follow along, but they don't have access to professors, and they don't get any kind of course credit. And print editor Mark Georgiev says that was fine with him. He's got a graduate degree from Yale, but wanted to learn how to write computer software. He discovered MIT's Foundations of Software Engineering class and downloaded it.
I didn't want a certificate. I didn't want any kind of accreditation. I really just wanted the knowledge, and I also wanted to work at my own pace.
Georgie finished the course in a few months' time. Now he says he can write rudimentary programs. His only expense was buying books. College students have mixed feelings about success like Georgie's. After all, they often pay thousands of dollars in tuition to learn what he did.
All right, let's get started. Sorry I'm a little late. Good to see you all.
At this University of North Carolina graduate business class, some students, like Hong Kong immigrant Anna Hoi, applaud the program.
It's not something you can be selfish. Education should not be profit-seeking. Because, like, a lot of people in this world, they don't have money to go to college, and this will be the best chance for them to, like, get some kind of education.
But an informal survey I did in her business class showed that more than half the students don't want their courses shared for free. And it's not just about the money. Student Denny Lyon says he'd be against it even if he were on full scholarship.
We're the ones asking the questions, directing classes, and I guess I have a huge problem with everyone else being able to get benefits off my own intelligence or my own ideas.
But MIT professor Eric von Hippel says keeping ideas secret is old economic thinking. Society gains when intellectual property is democratized.
When you put something on the web, like, for instance, when MIT puts a course on the web, the result is that other people download it but also improve it.
About 80% of the Institute's professors take part in the program, but some, like MIT business professor Michael Cusimano, came into Open Course kicking and screaming.
It was decided on at the highest levels, and basically we were then told the Institute was going to do this.
Cusimano says MIT sold its assets and its professors short, and that could devalue an MIT degree.
We are really in the business of selling intellectual property or intellectual content. Our course material is very important, and so giving it away, I think, harms the people that are paying tuition.
Cusimano charges that Open Course was originally a way for MIT to attract foundation money. The program receives some $25 million that way. Ann Margulies is Open Courseware's executive director.
Well, the motivation was certainly not to make money. MIT's fundamental mission is to advance education and to serve the world.
So far, the site attracts more than 1 million visitors a month. MIT hopes to have every course available online by this fall. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Coming up, the downside of the dating game in China.
A lot of my girlfriends are single. Unless they're willing to totally discount the social situation and go in with the C guys. But it's very rare for the A girls to go out with C guys.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial slipped 48 points today, more than a third of 1% to close at 12,738. The NASDAQ edged up 5 points, about a fifth of 1%, to finish at 2518. The S&P 500 ticked down 2 points, more than a tenth of 1%, to end at 1457. Hewlett-Packard clicked down more than 4.5% today. The world's biggest personal computer maker projected profits below analysts' expectations yesterday after the bell. Some other tech stocks followed suit today. Intel off nearly 1.5%. Sun Microsystems also shone about 1.5% less brightly. Novastar Financial tumbled 42% today. That's a 4.2%. The company announced a net fourth quarter loss yesterday, said it was thinking of changing its status as a real estate investment trust. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 4.69%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Since 1937, supporting the role that an experienced financial advisor can play in building a well-rounded financial program. The Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk is supported by the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship. Online at kauffman.org. Want to know what's in the works at Marketplace? How about getting the latest news and features in an email? Sign up for the Marketplace Midday Update. It will keep you up to date on the day's business news and let you know what to expect on our next program. Go to marketplace.org and click on the newsletter link on the right.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Thursday. The International Atomic Energy Agency unveils a report. It's expected to officially confirm that Iran has not halted its uranium enrichment program, something that could lead to further sanctions. It's the NBA trading deadline. And for you foodies out there, it's National Chili Day. Organizers say it's a chance to recognize chili as an American staple. It's also a good time just to eat some. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The head of the World Trade Organization said today he's got a good feeling the latest round of global negotiations are going to work out just fine. Pascal Lamy added, though, that the U.S. will have to make some concessions, and he said he'd love to see things wrapped up before President Bush's trade negotiating authority expires at the end of June. That authority is known as Fast Track. It lets the White House make deals Congress can't really change. Democrats on Capitol Hill have a list of things they'd like from the president in return for extending that authority, like attaching fair labor standards to international trade agreements. Commentator Robert Reich says that would be good for everybody.
The labor standards shouldn't be too high for developing nations to achieve. After all, if we require their workers to have the same wages or working conditions as Americans, jobs won't go there. That's called protectionism. One alternative is to borrow from the International Labor Organization and bar slave labor, forced labor, and the labor of very young children, as well as recognize the right of free association, which means the right of all workers to form unions. Much of the world already recognizes these core labor standards, and it wouldn't be too much of a stretch to require all our trading partners to do so as well. We should also push developing nations to raise their labor standards as their economies grow. One possibility would be to require that they set a minimum wage that's half their median wage. So as their economies grow and their median wages rise, more of their people will share the gains from trade. America would benefit in two ways from this. First, more of their people could then turn around and buy our exports. Second, these nations would develop larger middle classes, providing political stability and laying the groundwork for democracy. Of course, this sort of requirement would be hard to monitor and enforce. Most developing nations don't have minimum wages to begin with and don't keep careful track of what people are paid. So we might have to help them. But this would be true of almost any labor standard. Market fundamentalists will object that establishing any minimum wage in any developing nation will force some poor workers out of jobs and into the black market. But that's what they said almost 70 years ago when America first established its own minimum wage. A minimum wage, like health and safety standards, is the hallmark of a civilized society. Maybe the biggest hurdle is that this requirement will force us to set and keep our own minimum wage at half our median, which would be about $7.50 in today's dollars. Yet, presumably, we have as much interest in developing a stronger middle class here in the United States as we do elsewhere around the world. Don't we?
Robert Reich is a professor of public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. He used to be the labor secretary for President Clinton. Do take a second to send us your thoughts. Go to marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. This is the year of the pig, as you might have heard, specifically the year of the golden pig in the lunar calendar. It comes only once every 60 years, and that's lending special significance to Lunar New Year celebrations taking place in China this week. Children born this year are supposed to have easy and happy lives. But young Chinese adults are having some tougher times. Tens of millions of them are unmarried and too busy working in the new Chinese economy to look for spouses, so their parents are lending a hand, as Marketplace's Scott Tong reports now from Shanghai.
People's Park is the kind of central park of Shanghai. You can fly kites, feed the pigeons, and find a spouse for your child. Every Saturday afternoon, a few hundred 60-somethings amass at what's called Parents Matchmaker's Corner. This mom has a 28-year-old daughter. She works long hours at a multinational company. There's no old-school arranging marriages going on here. It's more for parents to facilitate the process of their only children getting hitched and producing heirs. The parents mingle, they whip out photos, and they trade phone numbers. And each child is represented by a laminated sheet of paper, a resume slash personals ad. My assistant Linda Lin reads one of them. Single Asian woman, college degree.
BA.
Uh-huh.
U.S. company. Department manager. Fat monthly salary.
Fat salary. Is seeking out.
Good looking, integrity, above 1.75 meters, BA or above, stable job, and income.
And he must own a house or apartment, as in renters need not apply. This old man explains. He's spouse hunting for his granddaughter.
男孩子一般的都要
If you're a man and you don't own a house or apartment, you don't even have a financial base.
Most folks here represent single women, and most don't tell their kids they're here. Why? Perhaps because their kids would be horrified. Jane Hua is similarly creeped out. She's 30.
It's your child, not community. You can just put everything in the paper and say, what's your daughter's condition and what my son's condition is, blah, blah, blah. If my parents won't go here, definitely no, never.
Then she suggests very politely that we leave. So we chat indoors about qualified single men in Shanghai and why the apparent tight supply chain. Some say the best men have gone overseas, for school or for work. Others cite a statistical surplus of career women in the city. But 30-year-old Yi Yin says it's culture. She says lots of men on her A-list have trophy wives.
Generally, A guys are attracted to B kind of girls, means not their equal. Less powerful and less prettier, younger, and more submissive.
Which leaves the successful A-list women out of luck.
And you left being single. So that's why a lot of my girlfriends are single. Unless they're willing to totally discount the social situation and go in with the C guys. But it's very rare that for the A girls go out with C guys.
Jane Hua seems not so picky. She subscribes to the all-you-need-is-love school. She doesn't care about a man's salary or his home ownership. But her parents, they care. And so they come to Matchmaker's Corner at People's Square to scout out mates for their kids. This couple is here for the first time. Mom notes the stiff competition for their daughter. Dad has stage fright. What do I do, he asks. Just go up to someone and start talking to them?
Do you want the boys to inform Asian or the girls?
Now here's someone who isn't shy, a boyfriend-girlfriend broker. She asks me what I'm looking for, and then I tell her. And then she whips out a list of several hundred women. Not surprisingly, this broker has more available women than men. But that may eventually change. All across China, a lot more baby boys are born than girls. Many people still prefer sons. Statistically, many of those sons will eventually become lonely bachelors, which will improve the marital bargaining position of Chinese women. In Shanghai, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note, coming soon to a shopping center near you, Whole Oats, or perhaps Wild Foods is a more fitting moniker. Could be fun, but chances are it'll still be Whole Foods Market, where today the organic food giant has acquired its smaller rival Wild Oats for about $565 million plus debt. Breaks down to about $18.50 a share. That's a 17% premium on today's close. Not a bad deal, though. Wild Oats has 110 stores in the U.S. and Canada, generates about $1.2 billion in sales every year. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow dropped 48 points, more than a third of 1%. The NASDAQ picked up 5 points, a fifth percent. The S&P 500 lost 2 points, more than a tenth of 1%. Our editors include John Buckley, Margaret Koval, Karen Lowe, Stacey Vanek-Smith, and Lisa Tucker. Next time, have you ever thought about buying property in the fourth dimension?
We're buying the idea of having property.
You know, you see most apartments around here. It's not a stretch of the imagination to move into some place you could barely fit into. That's par for the course.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.